Hey, this is side two of the interview with Fred Zitzer. Okay, go ahead now. This is working.
As I was saying, Germany was bombed with a lot of incendiary bombs, which would hit the buildings and burn them then pretty much to the ground. So the framework was standing, but people were living in the lower floors, so we would have to shovel off a lot of dirt and stuff like that so that they could live in there. We were located in smaller PW camps. Sometimes you might wonder whether they really were, because they might just have been a building that was supervised by them. But the first couple of camps we were in were pretty close to what a camp looked like. They had wire and stuff around, and pretty well guarded, and so on. But we were actually bombed out of about five or six PW camps like that. I mentioned before that we bombed during daytime, and the British bombed at night. So if I can draw a picture for you here. People went to work in the morning, and they'd probably take what was of value with them, and then the planes would start coming over, and they'd blow the air raid signal, which would mean the planes are coming in your district. So they'd drop what they're doing and go to the air raid shelters, and then the planes would maybe not drop the bombs, would fly over, and then you get the all clear, and then they go back to work. And then the planes now would be returning later, and you get the air raid again, and so they don't know whether they got anything left or they're going to drop them. You have to go back in the shelter again, and then the all clear comes, and then you go back to work and so on. And then at nighttime, you're home, and the bombers come over, and you can imagine what kind of pressure the Germans were under during that period of time.
Yes.
And we weren't too unhappy, because they did have good bunkers.
They did have good bunkers for you to go into.
And then we could go in with them. And
they did allow that. That was part of it.
We were part of their workforce.
Mm, okay.
And it wasn't any fun, though, to listen to them. If looks could kill, we'd all be dead now. And we knew what was going on.
Yeah, you could understand some German.
Well, yes, I could. I was the interpreter for our group.
Oh, you were, so you knew what was going on.
In lies some problems that I developed as a result of having that responsibility. I'll mention that later. Mm-hmm. But when we were in our PW camp at night, we weren't too secure, because all we had were slip trenches with about 4 or 5 feet of dirt. And luckily, we were hit, the three or four camps that were hit badly, and we were hit by incendiaries, and it didn't do anything but burn the building down. Had it been any kind of heavy stuff, we'd have been dead. And that's another harrowing experience. They were sitting in a little shell like that, and you hear those bombs coming down whistling. You hear them coming down, and I mean, you don't know where they're going to be.
Yeah.
Talk about sweating it out. That was some harrowing experience. Now, being in there with the Germans, they were hitting us, you know, because we were sitting right there, and they're protecting us, and their stuff is getting bombed, you know. So, in fact, the thing that kept most of us going were the guys that had the faith and knew that we were eventually going to win, because we knew we were beating them.
Mm-hmm.
We were captured. We were kicking them around, and we had underground stuff established with the other. You had German, you had Russians, you had French, you had Italians, Scandinavians. Every nationality was working. You know, the men were gone, and they gave their civilians the population a choice. You can go to Germany and work, or you can join the army and be a soldier. And of course, a lot of them joined the army, but a lot of them weren't. Most of the women, of course, were in the workforce.
Sure.
And that was what was going on in Germany. My experience there, though, was that I think it's about as low as a person can be and still be considered human. Is we lost all of our dignity. There was nothing we could do. You're reading about how tough we're treating those mm-hmm. Iraqi guys at the present time. Mm-hmm. It's that those guys are in heaven down there compared to what we were in mm-hmm. the camp. We had no say about anything. They told you to do something, and if you didn't do it, they clobbered you. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they didn't hold any punches. I was our interpreter for our group, and we knew we had some rights, mm-hmm. but when we demanded our rights and so on and so forth, they laid down the law, mm-hmm. and I was the guy that was bringing the complaints. Mm-hmm. We had guys that were sick, we had guys mm-hmm. that couldn't go out to work, we had guys that were dying, mm-hmm. we weren't getting any medical supplies, we weren't getting our food that we were supposed to get, we were getting the clothing mm-hmm. we were supposed to get. We were captured in the summer, so we had our summer heavy morning. Stuff we had was our combat jacket. Mm-hmm. And we had to go out and work, whether it was below zero or mm-hmm. snow on the ground or what. And there wasn't any. And the guys that couldn't do it, they just took them away. Mm-hmm. We don't know what happened to them. They just destroyed them. Food was... let's say we were supposed to get Red Cross parcels. We did occasionally, but very rarely. Mm-hmm. And our rations were, they gave us a loaf of bread a week. They had this dark, heavy bread, which you could break up and eat. You had an ersatz coffee, a substitute coffee that you could have. They gave us a lot of soup, a potato soup, but it wasn't Campbell's. Mm. Soup, it was water and soup, you know, and hot water with potatoes, basically. We never saw any meat and vegetables and things like that.
When in adjusting to this food or the water, did a lot of people wind up with diarrhea in the process?
We did, early on, yeah.
Early on, yeah,
and
until you got acclimated.
System gets acclimated to it, right. We lived in bunks, straw bunks, full of lice. Mm-hmm. And they deloused us once a month. They took us into these yeah. places and deloused us. Mm-hmm. But then we went back to this place where we were, and you were right back. We had guys that were just covered with lice, you know, mm-hmm. guys had skin problems, and you didn't have any showers. You had mm-hmm. you had some running water, but you didn't get any soap. Mm-hmm. You didn't have any soap around, so you just washed and. The stuff we had, the blades and stuff that we had, was mm-hmm. stuff that we captured with, and mm-hmm. you took off half your face. But nobody was shaving too much either. No. But you know, doggone lice get in their beards.
And, oh, and it would be awful.
Awful, yeah. And, but the food.
Did they cut your hair once in a while? Were you able to get your hair cut a little bit?
We had to do all that stuff ourselves, yeah. And we were able to get some. Stuff via the underground. We worked with, you know, Frenchmen and mm-hmm. and Russians and what have you, and it seemed like we could always smuggle something in mm-hmm. there to take care of a few problems. But it was really pretty rough going. I weighed about 155-60 in my mm-hmm. fighting days. When we were liberated later on, I was around 100, so you can imagine what that was like.
Left, yeah.
And we worked hard, we put in the full day's work, and we didn't get a fair deal at all. Mm-hmm. And occasionally you'd get a break. We worked for civilians sometimes. They'd have problems mm-hmm. With their homes, and we'd go in mm-hmm. and work with them, and in doing that, sometimes you get a little extra bread, or you get a little some yeah. extra eat, mm-hmm. and that was basically what our mm-hmm. we got a little marmalade too, along in there, marmalade jam was what it was, not jam marmalade, mm-hmm. you know, that orange,
orange peel
and
stuff. Yeah.
it was a pretty rough go.
You said you were the translator because you spoke German. Were very many of the guys, troops, able to speak German that were in prisoners when they got out?
I don't think so at the first. There weren't too many, no. At least they didn't own up to it.
Okay.
And then, of course, as you began to be there, we were there 9 months, and you began to pick up words and things of that nature. So they began to...
So when you went and worked out and with civilians, you were able to do some communicating.
Most of the time you were
like you did.
They never left you without a guard. But when you were working with civilians, they didn't object to. Early in the war, we couldn't do anything mm-hmm. like that. You couldn't recognize anybody or talk to anybody like that. Mm-hmm. But as the war was winding down and they were losing, and it was obvious they were losing it. Things were beginning to change, and people were trying to become a little more friendly because their handwriting was on the wall.
Sure.
And you could sense it with the guards, too.
Okay.
They knew what was going on. We pulled an escape right around Christmas time. There were three of us. I could speak German, one could speak a little Russian, the other guy could speak a little French. So we thought we could make it to the Swiss border. We were in Augsburg most of the time, southern Germany.
Uh-huh.
And we thought we could maybe make it to the Alps,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't have any idea of what the Alps were like or what we would have done if we'd have got there. But at this time, we were at a camp that was pretty well wired in, and they had a deal where the guards would walk around place all night, but up until dusk they would just go so far, and then they would see each other over here, and they mm-hmm. would cut that. So at dusk you had some time there that you could do something without mm-hmm. them really cutting through. So we got some wire cutters and stuff, and at dusk we worked our way through, and just as we were about halfway through, the guy turned his lights on. And he was just testing them.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't realize that. We thought mm-hmm. he'd turn them on, and he had it right on us, but he turned right off. Because they just saw us, they'd have killed us right there.
Mm-hmm.
But we did cut through, and we were gone about 7-8 days, and we were going south. And we went to Landsberg. We got in the Landsberg area, and there we blundered into an anti-aircraft unit. And this is the time of the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm, okay.
And they were having some success there. Mm-hmm. And this young lieutenant there, he gave us a bunch of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
What are you guys, nuts? So you stick with us. We're driving you guys right back into the ocean, you know. We had a little success at the beginning of it. Of course, we knew better than that, but you had to take it.
Uh-huh.
And then they sent us back to from Landsberg, they sent us back to Augsburg, and there they gave us solitary confinement for about 2 weeks on bread and water. But mm-hmm. that's basically
what you had anyway.
But another story there is Landsberg is where Hitler was locked up after the beer hall push, you know, down in München.
Okay.
And that's where he wrote his book, Mein Kampf.
Mm, okay.
So my claim to fame is that I was in the same clink that
Hitler was
in the Landsberg prison.
Yeah. The same prison.
And when we went back there, I took my wife to the place where mm-hmm. we were. And
sure.
And then to Landsberg, and, mm-hmm. and we went through that.
What's it like now?
Oh, it's
preserved.
That was one of the most amazing things in my life. We went back 45 years later. It was, and when we left Germany, all of Germany was leveled.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was leveled. You can't imagine. You can't imagine how bad it was. There wasn't a town that wasn't bombed, and mm-hmm. the places that they defended when the artillery and the tanks and stuff rolled through there, they just leveled those towns. And when we went back, it had been rebuilt. Like you couldn't even tell that it looked just like it did before. They
rebuilt it with the same pattern.
They did a tremendous job of rebuilding a country. And what they have done, though, is they have, in a lot of the major cities, they have left a building or two standing to remind them of what it was like. Like in Berlin, you got a famous little church there, like in the main drag on, I forget the name of the street now, Kufendammstrasse, something like that.
Yeah, but wife and I have walked by that church in Berlin.
Did you?
Yes, we were there for just a couple weekends.
But I was amazed at how they had redone it to make it look, as you know, those streets aren't like ours. They run every which way.
Yeah, that's right.
And how they rebuilt that to get back to where you couldn't tell that they really had it. I was flabbergasted when I saw it. Yeah, but...
Sorry for the diversion, but I thought that was interesting.
That's the trouble with this stuff. When you start talking, there's so many things come to mind.
Yeah, that's right.
Or come back to mind. Uh-huh. And it's kind of fun, but to reminisce once in a while. But getting back to the prisoner of war thing there.
You were in confinement for a period of time.
And then things began to get worse for him. Mm-hmm. And we were, I wouldn't say we were being accepted more or less, but they knew the handwriting was on the wall, and but that didn't help us any. We still had to go out and do what we had to do. But at the end of the war, then they didn't know really what to do with us, because the Russians were coming from the east.
Mm-hmm.
And the Americans were coming from the west, and so they took us from Augsburg, and they were going to evacuate us towards the Alps. But then, as soon as we got out of town, the crowds all disappeared, and so now we were on our own. And so we went back into Augsburg, and as I say, we had worked for some of these families.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to. One of the families that I'd gotten to know, and I stayed with them for about a week or two before the troops actually got in. And it was a good thing that I did, because I guess it's just a minor drop in the bucket, but I was mentioning all the displaced persons that were in there, millions of them, and now all of a sudden it's all gone. They're all gone. All the troops are gone, and all the law and order is gone, and here are all these people running wild now.
Yeah.
And they're going into these homes, and they're just raping and looting and stealing to any kid. So I stayed with this family for a while, because they were good to us.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I was communicating with them, and the guys would come in, and out of here. I was here first, or somewhere else, and stayed with them until the Americans got there, and then we reported them. And I still communicate with those people.
Is that right? You still keep in touch with them? Oh, that's great.
We visited them a number of times, and they've taken us through Germany and other parts of. It's kind of fun to go visit with those people. They go where the locals go and visit.
Yeah, that's the whole difference when you go with the locals.
About it, but,
that's right.
That whole experience was one that a lot of people didn't know about. They all thought we were getting Red Cross parcels, and they thought we were living in luxury. And and you have all these shows that came out, like Hogan's Heroes, where they were making the matches look like they were dumbbells, and these guys were making fools. And it was anything but that. It was about as cruel and as rough and tough as you could. You had lots of attempts at escapes, and if you didn't make it, they killed you.
That was just it.
And when we were escaping, we thought we might try some civilian clothing, but the more we talked about it, it was unwritten there. If you were caught in your uniform, you're okay. If you were caught with civilian clothes, then you were a spy or something, and they could have shot you
for being a spy.
Okay. So we went that route. We traveled by night, basically, and as I said, it was downfall. But we got about 50 miles, and
you did. Well, then where did you hide out at night?
Well, we stayed in the country, you know, mm-hmm. and went just around, the city as much as we could. And
what'd you do for food and water?
Steal whatever we could get, you know.
Yeah, right, where you could find it.
It was a crazy plan, but we were crazy kids. And
sure, you were in Yogan.
And that's what they taught us to do. Create as much havoc as you can.
Yeah, yeah.
I never saw so many dumb guys that would say, ich verstehe nicht, nicht verstehe, nicht Deutsch sprechen, you know. You know, act as dumb as they could.
Good, yeah.
And wherever they could screw up, they'd screw up. Yeah, you know, yeah, and yeah. That was it. But that, as I say, that got misinterpreted there, and it's a shame. And there's been some great books written. Mm-hmm. I have one right here that I recently got. It's called The Last Escape. It tells about the thousands, literally thousands of mm-hmm. Guys that were captured and then put on the Eastern Front. Mm-hmm. And they marched those guys in the dead of winter, 500 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them just didn't make it. Mm-hmm. And if they couldn't make it, they fell by the roadside and they shot them right then and there. Mm-hmm. And if you ever get a chance to read it, that's a great book to read.
It tells the
true story of how confusing the picture was, because mm-hmm. the Red Cross and so on was allowed to come into Germany, but they pretty much controlled what they could see.
Sure.
And the reports that the Red Cross were getting and giving had nothing to do with what was actually occurring, you know, mm-hmm. on the actual front there. And now we, as I say, when I read about how we were mistreating these Iraqi prisoners down there, it made me sick to my stomach to have to listen to that stuff and compare it to what PWs went through in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Not only in Japan, but in
Europe,
as well. So I thought I would put a little more emphasis on that than I would at this time.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the as far as our feelings about, did we really think it was worthwhile? We certainly did. We went into it pretty much fully aware that our country's democracy was at stake.
Mm-hmm.
We were aware of Japan taking care of Asia, wanting mm-hmm. expansion. We were aware of Hitler's wanting more Lebensraum, mm-hmm. living space for his people. All the phony deals he put together with, supposedly with Chamberlain,
mm-hmm. and
then cut it loose, and they did the same thing with Czechoslovakia. In Austria, he just bullied everybody, and there was, it was, handwriting was on the wall, mm-hmm. and I think most people knew it at that time. And we truly felt that that we were doing what we had to do. There wasn't a lot of, I didn't hear of anybody leaving the country to go to Canada, get out of the war, and stuff like that. There were guys that were conscientious objectors. And there were, you know, guys that were 4F.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the guys that were 4F were unhappy about it because they all felt they wanted to go, you know.
That's right.
And
someone would do anything to get around it, too.
Right. A lot of guys lied about mm-hmm. things to get in. And mm-hmm. there was a true feeling of getting in and mm-hmm. doing a job. Of course, later on, knowing what war was all about, I'm not so sure we would have felt the same way. But I don't have any regrets. I don't feel bad about anything. I pretty well put all those experiences behind and moved forward. And we were in the depth of depression.
Yeah,
we were a so-so country struggling at that time. We came out of World War II at the top pinnacle of the world, and we've remained up there ever since.
Now, when you were in France fighting the war, Did you guys know about the Jewish concentration camps by that time?
No, no, we did not. And nobody pretty much knew about that until they found it.
Yeah.
Including a lot of the German civilians didn't know anything about it.
Didn't know anything about it either.
It seems hard to believe, but people don't understand what it's like to live under a dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
When the Nazis took over, whether you... And you have to read that book sometime, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's amazing how the Nazi Party was actually able to get into power.
Yeah.
But everything fell just right. Bismarck was dying, and the country was in depression, and the reparations that Germany had to pay to England and France was staggering, and they were in depression as well.
Sure.
But a lot of things politically had to fall in line.
Yeah.
Because originally the Nazi Party was pushed out.
Mm-hmm.
The Communist Party was stronger than the Nazi Party was. But then everything fell in line, and once the Führer got in charge, he had two organizations. The first one was the SA group, that was his henchmen who helped the party get started. And then the party got so strong that he had to develop his SS organization to wipe out the SA boys.
Yeah.
Do you know that story about
that? No, I haven't heard all that detail, though, that I knew there were some different frictions at all powers.
They were together, and Strom was his name, was trying to upstage Hitler.
Hitler, okay.
Hitler invited all the boys down to a chalet down in southern Germany. They were going to have a party.
Mm-hmm.
They got those guys all drunk, and then they went to bed, and the SS boys murdered them all that night while they're sleeping. They're all the top dogs.
Mm.
And that was the end of the SS, SA boys.
SA boys, sure.
And once the SS and the Gestapo took over, they dictated to what you should do. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't, you talk about the concentration camps. When these concentration camps first started, that's what they were, concentration camps.
Yeah.
The political objectors, the professors and people who were opposed there, they were put in these conscientious objectors' place.
Mm-hmm.
And then, that didn't go along with the regime was a...
Disappeared.
He's gone. And then then where did they begin to put him?
Mm-hmm.
Was in these Thule concentration camps. But the original concentration camps were designed primarily for political
purposes.
Dissidents and stuff like that. And then, of course, Hitler had this plan getting rid of the Jewish people. And that was not a plan that was known by everybody. It was known only by the Gestapo, and Mr. Himmler was the guy that was in charge of that particular program. And they kept things pretty well under wrap.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when the guys first opened up those camps at Dachau and places
like that,
they were flabbergasted.
Mm-hmm. What they saw, so it must have been the worst. It must have been the worst.
Well, I went through those camps after, before
you came back from World War II.
I didn't have a chance to come back. We didn't really hear about that until years later.
Yeah, maybe I got to interrupt a little bit, but okay. The American soldiers came, you were staying with his family. Then kind of what happened as they picked you up
as soon as they came in and established their presence, then we reported into them.
Okay.
And what they did with us was they took us by truck from Augsburg to a place called Erlangen.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some flights out of there, C-47s, that flew us to Le Havre. And then at Le Havre, they gave us an examination, and they cleaned us up, and they gave us some food.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have the psychiatrists and psychologists
they
that we have today, see? And so nobody knew what and how to treat us.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there was anything like post-traumatic stress syndrome. Mm-hmm. You're either shell-shocked or war-weary or terms like that, you know. And in fact, Patton didn't know the difference. He slapped the kid there. Yes. was under stress like that. He called him a coward and everything else.
Yeah.
And I give Patton a lot of credit for being a general, but he had a lot of faults about him too, and he earned the title Blood and Guts, but it was our blood and his guts that pretty well did it. But anyway, so they really didn't know what to do with us, and other than get us home as quick as good. So we were at Le Havre, Lucky Strike, and they sent us home by Liberty ships, and these are these small boats.
Yeah.
Well, we went over on the SS Roosevelt. That was a big troop ship, about 10,000-15,000 guys, and that was a nice smooth ride. Coming home on these Liberty ships, the sea was rougher than a cod, you know.
Yeah.
And it took us about 14 days to get across. I think I was seasick about 10 days.
Yeah.
And all they were playing was, I'm going to take the sentimental journey, Dorothy.
Played that over and over.
And there we were, hanging over the side, puking our guts out.
Feeding the fish.
but we got home at, this would have been, the war ended May 8th. Mm-hmm. And this would have been already, war wasn't over yet when we left. We were home already when the war ended.
Oh, you were back.
Right. I can't remember the dates now, right offhand now. Mm-hmm. But we came back to Camp Lucky Strike, Camp Miles Standish in Boston is where we landed.
Well, that's where
that's right. Also where we sailed from.
We did go out of Boston.
And we went over, we went to Meade, Fort Meade, then from Fort Meade to Miles Standish, and where we landed, Liverpool, and we went down to Southampton, and then across the channel and into Normandy. Coming home, we landed at Boston, and then they put us on trains right away. Mm-hmm. And they shipped us up through Canada, and they took us back to Fort Sheridan, Chicago.
Okay.
I went home.
Up through Canada.
Not around to Detroit like that, and into Chicago, and up to Sheboygan. Up Chicago, and then we got a train ride from Chicago to Milwaukee Road up to Sheboygan, or Chicago Northwestern, I don't remember anymore. But when we got to Camp Fort Sheridan, they didn't want to do us either.
Yeah.
Okay, so what'd they do? They sent us home for a 90-day recuperation furlough.
Oh,
so we went home.
Uh-huh.
Went home, and the people at home, there's nobody home yet.
No,
and they didn't know how to treat us either.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine what it was like being a PW and now suddenly being free.
Yeah.
Oh, then being free, I was free.
Being free, yeah.
Couldn't believe it, and got home, and I certainly didn't consider myself a hero.
Mm-hmm.
I considered the guys that are dead over there.
Yeah, that's right.
I was a lucky survivor. But then coming home, why, people couldn't do enough for you.
Okay.
And of course, I'd been sending all my money home.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother had saved that for me.
Well, she had. Yeah. And of course, you didn't spend any when you were a prisoner.
So I had a little wallet full of dough there. And then these guys, everybody wanted to treat you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the first 30 days, I think I was drunk most of the time. You know, they wanted
everybody couldn't do enough
for you. And then you wanted to reciprocate in kind, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasted 90 days there.
Uh-huh.
And then they sent us back to Fort Sheridan. And in fact, we reported late because VJ Day occurred.
Oh, at that time.
And so everybody was going to stay home celebrate. And that was quite a celebration.
Yes.
In fact, when I got back to Chicago, they were still celebrating 3 or 4 days later. But nobody said anything. And We all had enough points. I couldn't understand why they didn't just discharge us.
Yeah.
But they didn't know what to do with us, whether they should keep us or just let us go. So they sent us to Fort Sam Houston for another 30 days. So we went down there. We laid around down there for 30 days doing nothing. And finally, they wound up sending us all the way out to Camp Adair, which is between Corvallis and Eugene. And then this was like September now.
Okay, both wars are over with.
So, yeah. And finally, they sent us from Fort Camp Adair to Sacramento. And they discharged us there.
In Sacramento.
And they could have saved all that time and money by just letting us stay home at that time. We all had plenty of points.
Yeah.
But I got discharged in September.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started school in January and got on with my career. The feeling there after the war was one of, okay, the war is over. Everybody was in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's old news.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to hear anything about it. They'd had enough of it. And we all wanted to go on with our careers.
Sure.
So I went to school and got an education. And that was interesting, too, because the professors didn't know how to treat us either. And they thought the ad hand was different than anybody else. And they really didn't, you know. Nobody was blowing smoke about how great they were. Mm-hmm. They were all happy to get out and get started again, start their lives.
Sure.
At least the younger guys were. I was only 21, 22 when I got out.
I
had everything ahead of me. And the war was the last thing we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because during all that time, I bet you I didn't have a handful of people who ever wanted me to come and talk about the war, this or that, or the war, how was the war, what. Wasn't until about the 50th anniversary where they celebrated again that everybody got excited by it. We better find out what happened back then and what's going on. In fact, they made such an area there with the guys that were in Vietnam War. These guys coming out with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And so they decided to get all the PWs back in 1984 and run them through just to check them out and see what...
Well, they were doing what they
sure
changed
enough,
anyway.
Sure enough, it was 84, that was 44. 40 years later, this guy's got post-traumatic stress syndrome. You know, 40 years later, so then I went to the whole deal, though, and they found out a lot of stuff, because I really got beat up pretty well.
Uh-huh.
And I eventually had to have both my hips replaced. I had back surgery, and had a lot of stuff there that we weren't aware of.
They hadn't checked out thoroughly.
We had terrible diets.
I would think you'd be at risk of that.
You're exposed to practically everything. Mm-hmm. Guys had, in those days they didn't fill your teeth, they pulled them out.
Yes, I remember that.
Well, there was to it, you know.
That's right.
There was a lot of stuff that was done.
Mm-hmm.
Use of different language, but we want
chemically. Well, that's how it was. Did you still have some shrapnel in the back, or what is that all?
I did have slivers of shrapnel in my back. I was in Denver in 86 or 87, and my wife had noticed some stuff on my back, and we went in and they took about five or six pieces out. They're about an inch or so long. I'm pretty lucky because I didn't get hit bad. I could have gotten hit bad many times. But,
it doesn't take much but an inch or two between life and death sometimes.
I prayed a lot.
Were you a religious person before you went in?
Yes, I was. And my favorite psalm was 23.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked through the valley of death.
Yeah, you did that. So you prayed a lot. Came out, you maintained your religious faith.
And yes, I did. Mm-hmm. I never lost it.
So good.
And that we had some very interesting experiences there too. We made the most of the seasons and Christmas mm-hmm. and stuff.
Sure.
Like that, what we had. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I really feel that we lost a lot of guys because they did lack faith. May not have been religion, but they had just lost faith.
Just didn't
they
have faith just
gave
anything.
Up.
Yeah, just quit.
Because things were tough.
Sure,
it had to be
easy
tough.
To give up.
It was very easy to give up, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I can't, you can't describe stuff like that mm-hmm. again to see it.
Sure.
But you could see the guy just giving up.
Sure. And what you can't describe is being pushed to the limit and then just
yeah.
doing almost any damn thing. When you talk
That's
about
right.
survival, it's just...
yeah, it's just like blowing somebody away.
Yeah.
And you got so close. We had mm-hmm. we had a lot of 100 yards away, and you got to get them out. There's a lot of hand-to-hand stuff that's
sure.
in there.
Yeah.
And I was a light 30 machine gunner. My lifespan was 6 minutes
mm.
in combat.
Oh,
so
sure,
but I lasted about 3 months, so I was
yeah.
pretty lucky.
Yeah.
I carried a .45.
Mm-hmm.
Those 30 calibers, they go right through you.
Mm-hmm.
And you get close like that, you get a guy with a
yeah.
45, you
can stop.
Stop.
Yeah,
you can
stop
the back, mm-hmm. blow his whole back out.
Mm-hmm.
45.
Yeah.
And that's no fun.
No, not any fun at all.
And it wasn't any fun being captured either, because the dead are laying out there,
mm-hmm.
and those are their friends coming to get them.
Yeah.
Right. So we didn't really feel that we had a chance.
No, you didn't feel very comfortable in that.
There's some times when you went through some pretty... But after a while, you get tough.
Yeah.
Not tough, but you get hardened. You get used to it.
Mm-hmm.
You see it day in and day out. And when that... some guys go...
Mm-hmm.
pretty good, and then others don't.
Yeah.
It's
others just very, break down. Some break yeah, down, I yeah. suppose. Or
they, and guys get scared. They,
yeah.
they just freeze, and they just mm-hmm. lie there. And they just lie there.
Mm-hmm.
Let somebody shoot them. They don't mm-hmm. afraid to shoot
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
But most of the guys handle themselves pretty well.
Yeah.
And as I say, you get to where you get acclimated to stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But you never really have a sense of comfort.
No.
You're always under duress.
Mm-hmm.
The feeling of, I don't think it was a feeling of relief. It was a feeling of, well, we did what we could and we were
mm-hmm.
captured and maybe you were out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was worse. Isn't anything worse than losing your freedom? You just can't say a word. You can say it, but you pay
yeah.
the price for it.
Yeah.
And I paid that price too often.
Yeah.
But,
now the guards in the
dignity is that you're
yeah.
just a piece of crap.
Yeah.
You're not even there.
You're nothing. Yeah.
You're a hindrance to them.
Mm-hmm.
If it gets bad, you don't care about you. We'll kill you. We'll get you out of the way and get rid of them. That's where you are.
Were the guards at the prisoner of war camp, were they older people then?
Most of the guys that were guarding us were guys that were home from the Western Front or from the Eastern Front and just were not capable of
fighting.
They were still capable,
holding my gun and
holding my gun and beating you, and you're helpless.
And you're not doing anything.
But they were. That was another tough thing to see. They had a pretty good fighting force at one time,
mm-hmm.
but at the end
yeah.
of the war, you had nothing but 12, 13-year-old kids and 65, 70-year-old men that were
trying to hold them together.
And the, you know, the army wanted to give up. They
knew
the way, but Hitler wouldn't let them do it. And and they defended, they tried to defend Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russians were all over that place.
Sure.
And in fact, we could have gotten into Berlin before the Russians could have. We sat there at the Elbe for a month before.
Waiting for them to come.
Because the big three had made, they'd already settled everything, who was going to do what.
Mm-hmm.
We could have got in. The 30th was sitting on the Elbe for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I think we hooked up with the Russians at Torgau.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't. And then I don't know if they were my buddies, because I don't think, it's a rare guy that went the whole route.
Yeah, I would think
because
so.
Because most of the guys were either killed or taken off and were replaced.
Because
the guys that finished the war were all a different bunch than the guys that started. Because I know that because I'd gone to my 30th Infantry reunions, and most of the old guys are gone. And they don't know anything about Normandy. They know about the Battle of Bulge. We did a great job at the Battle of Bulge. The 30th Division was one of the Battle of Bulge was really quite a battle. There must have been. They always refer to the Battle of Bulge as the Battle of Bastogne, 101st against the Germans, but it wasn't. They had a front there of about 100 miles, all the way from Aachen down to almost to Trier. And you had about almost 50 or 60 divisions that were fighting. But the bulge broke out at Bastogne and around Liege in there. And of course, they hit at Christmas time. And they didn't